Well, let me start off by saying that stress is a killer, and it ruthlessly and relentlessly stalks its victims. Let me read to you a little real-life situation that hopefully none of you will ever have to identify with, but maybe it's something that you feared or something that you know someone else has gone through. There was a doctor, you told me that you were a physician, there was a doctor by the name of Dr. Robert S. Elliott, who has written a book called It's Not Worth Dying For. He's an international expert on stress and heart disease. Suddenly, one day, he became his own patient. And the experience, which nearly killed him, revolutionized his whole life. Now, as a doctor, he knew most of the traditional risk factors of heart disease, and he was careful. His father lived to 79. His mother was still healthy at 85, so he thought he had heredity on his side. He didn't smoke. He wasn't overweight. He had normal blood pressure and cholesterol count, and he thought he was immune to heart disease. Was he ever wrong? In the spring of 1972, everything collapsed around him. After an intense and particularly stressful period of time, lack of sufficient sleep and a horrible bout with anger, his mind began to get a little foggy. His eyes were slurry, he felt dizzy, and from this point on, I quote him, "Intense pressure went from my breastbone up into my shoulder, my neck, and my jaws, and down both of my arms. I had trouble breathing. I began to sweat. I went to the coronary unit, and I asked for some nitroglycerin tablets. No relief. I began getting bowel cramps, nausea. The pain got worse. I thought, the game is over. I asked the head nurse for a vacant bed, stretched out, and told her, I've just had a heart attack. The expert became the victim. Now here's the interesting thing. It might come rather startling to some of you. He discovered that more than 50%, obviously after this experience, he did a lot of research, probably out of curiosity for himself. How in the world could that have happened to me? He discovered that 50% of people who are stricken with heart disease had, like himself, no classic risk factors. The missing trigger, he decided, must be unbearable stress. He further researched it, and it led him to the conclusion that stress alone can raise human cholesterol levels, leading to a cardiac arrest and possible death. Stress is public enemy number one. A lot of people live under the illusion because their parents live to be an old age and everything looks great on the health reports when you go to the doctor, that you're all right. But that might not be the case, and it certainly wasn't the case in his situation. Consider the following. Of the 10 leading causes of death in America today, 8 of them are attributed directly or indirectly to stress. Experts agree that the average business executive, and I would put pastors in that category, has a 1 in 3 chance of dying of a heart attack before the age of 60. So if you're in the ministry, you're in kind of a high-pressured executive position, you've probably got a 30% chance of dying with a heart attack before you reach 60. Great news, huh? Our age is characterized by fierce competition, busyness, ambition, aggressiveness. The race is against time and for success. Noise and pollution further complicate our lives. And we desperately need to take action. We need to somehow get off of this treadmill and take a long look at what we're doing and why we're doing it. Stress actually weakens the body and makes you more susceptible to all sorts of ailments, tension, anxiety, and depression. Emotional stress today is the number one cause of ill health in the United States. If you start researching and finding people that are getting laid off work and that aren't showing up and that are sick, indirectly or directly, you can trace most of it back to stress. And it might not appear like it's stress, but stress causes other problems. So indirectly, it is stress that's at the bottom of it. Another interesting fact, that 85% of all headaches are stress and emotionally induced. They have no physical, actual physical reason. It's all related, once again, to stress. There was an alarming but highly informative article in Toastmaster magazine back in 1984. It was entitled, "Are You a Walking Time Bomb?" And in that article, it had the fact that 1 in 5 Americans, 20% of all of us, is operating under sufficient stress to trigger major heart disease. So as someone once put it, you know, you're an accident waiting to happen. And most of us aren't aware of it. We think, well, this is normal and this is the way life is, and we don't really pay too much attention to it. I had a pastor friend of mine out in California who was as skinny as a rail, was athletic, been athletic all of his days, seemed on the outward appearance to be relaxed and so forth and so on. And to the surprise of all of us, just almost out of the blue, he went into the hospital for a quadruple bypass. And we all kind of looked and said, "You got to be kidding. Him? You know, athletic, watches his, you know, it seems to do everything right." And as I looked at that, you know, and thought about it, I came to the same conclusion. Probably stress. He's not overweight, he doesn't smoke, he doesn't drink. And you start looking at all the things that you've eliminated, and what is left often is the stress factor. Well, let's give it a definition. What we're going to do from this point on, and I'll tell you where we're going, we're going to talk about the definition or the distinction between stress and burnout. We're going to talk about the characteristics, the causes, and the cures. So we'll take it in that order. The characteristics, the causes, and the cures. Stress is simply the body's response to any demand that's placed on it. Now, when stress is prolonged and it goes over a long period of time, then it can result in burnout. You might say the burnout is the end of the road. You start off with stress, and it continues and continues, and then you slide downhill and slip into burnout. Burnout has been defined as a state of physical or psychological exhaustion and is related to chronic, unrelieved pressure. To put it another way, the gas is gone, the barrel is empty. It's what Dr. Hart from Fuller Seminary calls compassion fatigue. You just don't have anything left anymore. You don't care. You're just empty. We're talking about between boredom and burnout. Can you all see this? Can you see it where you're sitting? Okay. There's an interesting relationship between productivity and stress. Actually, stress in itself is not bad. You need stress. Or you're just bored. I'm under a certain degree of stress right now in speaking. You know, my glands are moving, my adrenaline is flowing. An athlete, if an athlete didn't experience some stress, he or she would not perform all that well. It's when you get up for an event that you're under what we call a healthy dosage of stress. And so the amount of stress begins to rise and your productivity begins to go up. And you get to a certain point where you're at absolute peak performance. There's actually books out now that talk about peak performance and how to reach your optimal challenge point where you're just really moving, and it's all healthy. Somewhere up in here, you step over the line and you've gone from challenge into too much stress, and you start sliding downhill until you eventually reach a point of burnout. So what we actually want to do is find the balance. We want to have that point of challenge. I was talking to Dr. Larry Kies, who's the president of Overseas Crusade, and anybody in that position, I mean, on the road 50% of the time, making heavy, heavy decisions. And I showed him this. We were discussing where would be the good spot to be. Would it be over in here, just a little bit over the line, or would it be better to be just a hair behind? We disagreed. I told him I'd rather be right there. He said, "I just want to be maybe a half a step over so that I could realize and pull back." Now, here's a real key. It's to figure out where that spot is for you. And that's not always easy to do. Some of you might be living down in here and not be aware of it. Some of you might be over there thinking that this is the way it's supposed to be. But it's finding that spot of challenge so that your productivity is high, you're not bored, neither are you burned out. It's like a rubber band. You know, if a rubber band is just like this, it really doesn't serve any purpose. A rubber band was created to be stretched. And so, you know, we stretch it, we wrap it around something, and that's the whole purpose of it. However, the rubber band has its limits. If you pull it out too far and keep pulling and pulling, or you do this consistently, it's going to wear it down to the place where it's going to have a weak spot, and eventually, I won't do it, it's going to snap. And so you're trying to find that optimal place where you're stretched, where it's healthy, where you're enjoying it, where you're challenged, but not where you go out too far, where the result is that it weakens and just dissolves or snaps. None of us want that to happen. There's a fellow by the name of Sile who's supposed to be the father of stress. It seems like various subjects of expertise, we always have the father of missions and the father of this, and so he's called the father, and he, if you want to read the book on stress, it looks about like this. And he simply defined it as the non-specific response of the body to any demand. So a demand is placed on your body and you respond to it, and that's stress. Now, if it's in the ballpark, it's okay. If it's way beyond your capacity and your limits, then you get the undesirable effect. Okay, let's talk about some characteristics. Now, as we're going through both characteristics and causes and cures, what we're going to have is just a kind of a list of various things. And what I'd like to have you listen for is anything that rings a bell with you to say, oh yeah, I recognize that. That's what I've been experiencing. Or that's what my friend who's been coming and talking with me is experiencing. So let's talk about some characteristics. Now, the characteristics that we're going to mention are like red lights on a dashboard. You know, you're driving along in one of our computerized cars and all of a sudden a red light goes on somewhere. And the red light is simply to alert you to the fact that something's wrong. Now, some people pull out the switch or they pull out the little computer chip so that they don't like to see the red light or they don't like to hear the buzzer ringing. Now they have computers actually talk to you and tell you your door's open or your trunk's open or this or the other thing. The thing to do is to listen to that red light, not try to figure out how to unplug it and get it to disappear so you're not pestered with it. You had a question?
Can you give us these characteristics? It's when it's an unhealthy amount of stress, not just a stress.
Yeah, these are things that if you recognize any of these things in yourself or someone else, it ought to trigger a red light in your mind that there's something that's not the way it should be. Now remember, some of us, or maybe all of us, will experience all of these things to a degree, but what we're talking about is a switch. This is not usually the way I am, or this is much more than I'm usually experiencing in this particular area. Okay, the first one is persistent feelings of anxiety, aggression, depression. Frustration, irritability, moodiness, nervousness, an overwhelming sense of loneliness or abandonment. And remember, you think, well, good grief, everybody's frustrated or fatigued from time to time, but we're talking about an unusual dosage where you seem abnormally fatigued or depressed, and that's usually not me. Oh, I get depressed once in a while, but not like this. You know, it's kind of overboard. Okay, emotional outbursts of hostility and anger. You just find yourself flying off the handle unexplainably. And you can't understand why. Uncontrolled eating or drinking. You're just on a binge. Uncontrolled use of uppers or downers. That's the way to refer to them. You find yourself taking pills more and more to get to sleep or to wake yourself up. Appetite loss, you just lose all desire, you find yourself skipping meals, you're just not interested in eating. Now for some of us that's not a bad idea. But if that's usually not the way you are, you usually have a good healthy appetite and all of a sudden you don't, this could be another indicator. Excessive daydreaming, find your mind wandering off. Not because you watch too many MasterCard commercials, but because you just have this constant desire just to chuck it all and get out of here and go away somewhere. And it's becoming to the place where it's more and more happening that your kind of mind's drifting off to Netherland. Difficulty in concentrating, or you find yourself forgetting frequently. Double booking yourself, forgetting to show up. It says your mind is just not functioning the way it used to. Now, what goes along with the A-type personality that some of us had is sometimes when a symptom like that comes up, instead of recognizing it and slowing down, we think, I can lick it. you know, I'll just redouble my efforts, I'll just give it the good old college try. So instead of seeing it as a warning to back off, we see it as a challenge to press ahead, and things get even worse. Some people just don't like to be sick, and when they think they're going to get sick, they try that much harder to stay well, and it almost complicates the problem. Now, those are not all the characteristics, but those are some of the prominent ones. Let's move on to some causes. Once again, not all of the causes, because you can make a list a mile long, but here are some of the prominent ones. Number one on the list is a sense that your life is out of control. You have no control over your life. Either your kids are running the show, your spouse is running the show, your employer is running the show. Everybody's running it but you. And you just feel like it's just getting away from you. Those that have done some research in this area have come to the conclusion that the biggest source of stress on the job is that you have no control over your job. Somebody's always dictating everything to you. And you just get this feeling that everything is out of your control. It just creates stress. The second major cause of stress, in addition to being out of control, is your personality type. We're going to help you identify that a little later on here. A third cause is the type of job you have. The types of job that create the most amount of stress are what we call people jobs. Somebody said, regarding an organization, asked another individual who was the CEO of an organization, he said, "Do you ever have any personnel problems?" The guy said, "Are there any other kind?" But people jobs, jobs like social workers, teachers, anybody in Christian work, where you're constantly dealing with other people's problems and carrying around their burdens and their concerns. A doctor would fall into that category. Doctor, this doesn't take care of the body. When that person comes in, you become, in a sense, lawyer and a therapist and psychiatrist and everything all rolled into one. It's almost like you're magic, and they want to share all of their needs and troubles. So you find yourself going home at night carrying other people's problems and burdens. It's a lot less stressful to dig a ditch or to paint a building than to deal with people. That's why we have so many people that get overstressed and bail out of the ministry. The turnover rate among pastors is absolutely horrendous. 3 or 4 years, I've heard, for in some areas of the country for a pastor to stay on the job. You find a pastor who's been somewhere for 10 to 15 years, it's rather unusual because of the stress that comes from working with people and all the conflicts relating to that. Okay, the next one is not recognizing and therefore exceeding your limits. The cause is that you really don't know what your capacity or limits are, so you're constantly overstepping it because you've never stopped to analyze. Where are my limits and the end of my capacity? When should I start saying no? The next one, unrealistic expectations of what you can achieve. Now, this has many sources. It can be trying to please a parent who has long since passed away, but nothing was ever good enough for mom or dad. And so you're still trying to impress your parents or prove to your dad or your mom that you are a success, that you can do something right after all. And so you're constantly pressing ahead, going way beyond what you're capable of, trying to prove something to somebody. Could be proving it to a brother who's achieved more financial success, or a sister, or a parent, or an uncle, or whatever the case might be. Unrealistic expectations that either other people place on you or that you place on yourself. And related to this is comparing yourself. Very easy for a pastor for one church to compare himself with the pastor of another church. Why is everybody going there? Why are people getting saved at that church and not here? And on the comparison goes. The most excruciating pain for some pastors and Christian workers is to attend the annual meetings where everybody compares notes as to what's happening and who's got the biggest buildings and the biggest budgets and so forth and so on. Unrealistic expectations. The next one, inflated ego needs. This is related, of course, to getting your significance and your security through production or achievement. And so you've got an inflated desire to really do something spectacular. And you keep pushing and pushing and pushing yourself until in some cases we just drop. Conflict is a tremendous source of stress. Conflict with the kids, conflict among spouses, conflict in the church. At the old McCoys, you know, get out your rifles and take sides and shoot at each other. I'm reminded of a story of a fellow in the Civil War who couldn't make up his mind whether he wanted to fight on the north or the south. He was living almost right on the border. So he decided what he would do is he'd put on a blue top and gray bottoms. The result was that they shot at him from both sides. You just can't win. But being in the middle of a conflict where you feel that you're always in conflict or the relationships are shaky causes stress. Blocked goals. You have this desire to do something and you just can't pull it off. Something keeps getting in the way. Children can be a tremendous source of stress. Now, someone has done something interesting that they have divided up stressors, as some people refer to them, stress stimuli, into external and internal. Let me read a couple of lists, just four or five items. First, we'll take the internal. That's what's actually going on inside of me that produces stress. A high need for approval. We might say an insatiable appetite for approval. Some of us will do almost anything short of killing ourselves to win the approval of somebody. Number two, under internal, is this workaholic. Just can't shut the engine down, just going night and day. We had a fellow quite a few years ago in the Navigators that fell into this category. He just didn't seem to have an off button. Ever meet anybody like that? He had an on, he had overdrive and high, and that was about it. And so what he'd do, he'd go for several months working, and then he'd just literally collapse. And they'd find him, you know, in his room, so we're just totally wiped out. We'd carry him to a motel for a couple of weeks and let him rest up and recuperate, and then he'd come back out refreshed and so forth, and he'd go right into the same cycle again, just push himself to the place where he literally dropped physically and emotionally. And then we'd carry him off to the hotel room for a couple of weeks. This is kind of the way his life went, up and down like this. Seemingly, he was not able to just turn it off and do anything else. He was, in the true sense of the word, a workaholic. A third internal cause is the unassertive, passive individual. So they create that stress because they don't say what they really feel, they don't say what they really think. It's yes sir, three bags full, and it creates all kinds of stress inside, but somehow they're just unable to say, I'm sorry, I can't do that, or I don't agree with this, but they just keep going along with the show, as it were, and it just literally eats them up over the long haul. The fourth, and some of you will recognize this, is what we call the Messiah complex. That I'm going to save the whole world, me, myself, and I. And so everything comes to my desk. I do everything. I have my fingers in every pie. I'm on every committee. How many of you are pastors in here? Okay, can you identify with that? Pastor's got to be at every meeting. I mean, if I don't see the pastor, I really haven't talked to anybody. Somebody has put it this way, that the monkey always climbs to the top of the tree. So they're always going to keep going until they get to see, quote unquote, the pastor. An elder won't do, a deacon won't do, an assistant pastor won't do. They've got to see the head man. And so everything comes our way. And in one sense of the word, that's very flattering, to know that I'm needed and that people want to know what I think and I can help them and so forth and so on. But pretty soon it can get to us that I'm the solver of everyone's problems, I'm everyone's counselor, and then we step way over the limits. But we create a role model for ourselves and we think that's what I'm supposed to be doing. And that's what other people expect, so I get locked into that, and I just sort of stay in it for long periods of time. And, of course, that will do you in. Okay, what about some external causes? The internal ones are all things that are going on inside of me, my attitudes, my conceptions, how I perceive things. Now, these are things that happen outside. Long hours at work. You've got to work overtime again tonight, Mary. But it's the fourth night this week we have to work overtime. I have other things I need to do. I'm sorry, Mary, you need to be here tonight. We absolutely need to have you here. So the hours get longer and longer, 50 hours a week and 60 hours a week. Well, I could take it for a couple of weeks, then it's 3 weeks, and it's a couple of months, and it just seems like it's never going to end, and it just gets to you. No help. You keep saying, well, we need more people in this department. I can't do this by myself. But as long as you keep trying, they don't hire anybody else. So they keep piling up your desk and giving you more and more and more. And somewhere in somebody's mind is the thinking, well, when she finally drops, then we'll give her some help. But as long as it looks like she can handle it, we can save some money, we'll just let Mary keep doing it. And I have met several people that have been in that situation where they just will not do anything until the person physically just collapses on their desk. They think they're saving money, but it's going to cost them in the long run. Too many changes. Somebody mentioned earlier when we were talking about, or you were sharing with me, Toffler, of course, has written the book Future Shock, and he lays out, actually has a little, and I've seen this in other places, sort of a point system where you get so many, points. Someone has died, and you change your job, and you had a new baby, and you know, on and on and on. And you go through this thing, and then, I mean, just going through the test and scoring, it's enough to give you a heart attack. And you get down to the end, and you think, good grief, 500 is supposed to be death, and I've got 790 points already. Well, you can't do something about some of these changes, but some of them you can. Don't move. Well, we're getting into cures, I better say that. But sometimes the change factors get piled up so high that are happening outside, we're not really aware of how many crucial, critical things have happened to us over the last year, and we wonder why we're strung out. Okay, the next one is lack of family and free time. Once again, it's related to the long hours, no help. And we don't have any time for our wives, we don't have any time for our kids. I'm reminded of the father who was just devastated when he was standing there and his young daughter turned to the mother when daddy was going out the door and said, Mommy, when is daddy going to visit us again? And he hung his head and it dawned on him for the first time how his kids were perceiving the fact that he was never ever there. And the kids look and they say, well, how come daddy has time to run all over the place and help all of these other people, but he never has any time to be home to play with us? That's a good question. And it demands an answer. No time for family, no time for recreation, free time. I've read biographies. One of the hobbies I have had over the years is to read Christian biographies. And back in the old days, people used to talk like it was something to be proud of to say that I haven't had a vacation in 10 years. And I'm so busy in the work of the Lord that I haven't taken a vacation in 10 years. Some people have said that it absolutely astounded me because they were people that I always used to put up on a pedestal. And I looked at that and I said, you read, and, well, I couldn't, they were long since gone, but the thought would occur in my mind, can you really mean to say that as a point of spirituality that you haven't had a vacation in 10 years? As if that, you know, puts you in a different category. But maybe back there, they didn't take vacations or something. I don't know. Not saying no, or the inability or the fear of saying no. Last week I was up to my ears in meetings, or 2 weeks ago. I had more meetings 2 weeks ago in that 1 week than I think I've had in the last 2 years. And so they were going to schedule one more meeting at 7:30 in the morning, and I thought, I wonder if they'll go for this. And I said, I really can't come to another morning meeting. I said, that's the time for devotions for the kids, for my quiet time, for exercise and things like this. Can I come in a little later? And they said, yeah, no problem. So I showed up at 8:30 instead. Just the fear of what will they think of me if I say no? Will they think I'm less spiritual or I'm not committed? But saying no. Okay, let's get into some cures. Test your limits to decide if you're a racehorse or a turtle. And then structure your life accordingly. That's the first step, is just to find out how has God wired you up. If you're a racehorse, you need to slow down. If you're a turtle, you need to maybe, put it another way, you could be on either end of the scale. If you're down here, you might think, well, I just need some more challenge. I need to get actually more stress so that I really find what I'm doing exciting and fulfilling. Others are out here and need to back off the other way. And we're somewhere in between these two extremes here.
What about when you're in transition? You know, they talk a lot about it, but it is true. I know, like, I'm 41 now. Physically, I cannot put in the hours that I used to. I always worked 60 to 70 hours when I was early.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be tired, but I'd bounce back the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Now I work usually 60, 65 hours, and I'm beat.
Well, we're changing, aren't we? We get older, we can't handle the same amount, and that's when we have to... I don't think that this analysis to say determine if you're a racehorse or a turtle is one you do one time. I think it's a process. You're always evaluating. Different things come into our lives. We have different demands placed on us. We might have health limitations. The ages of the children can determine how much time we can give to various things. There can be a variety of reasons, and it's a process of an ongoing analysis of where am I, and where are my limits, and how much can I handle. We're always changing and in flux.
Could it even be that in a spiritual sense that God calls you sometimes to be in a different time where it's a time in your life that He wants you to go slower, and that's why you're there?
Yeah. Yeah, we could almost put that in the category of pacing ourselves. We know it's a time that's going to demand a lot right now, so I'm ready for it because I've been pacing myself up to that point. It's like a runner. If you're going to run, I'm a runner. If I'm going to run a couple of blocks, obviously I'm going to go at a much faster pace than if I'm going to run 3 or 4 miles. And I have to know how long is this going to last. So if I had a particularly stressful time and I'm already running at top speed, that'll probably knock me out of the picture. But if I'm pacing myself to when I get to that time of real demand, I've got some margins, some reserves. In essence, it's somewhat like your finances. If you have $3,000 a month at your disposal, you don't budget to spend $3,000. You leave margins. So if something comes up unexpectedly, you've got a little buffer there. And the same thing is true in the area of stress. You say, well, I could take more stress, so I'll go out and get myself some more opportunity and say yes a few more times, so I'm right up against the wall. But then what happens when something big hits? Then you just collapse because you have no more margin left. So the thing is, even though you could move against the wall, back off and give yourself a little margin, so if something unexpected happens, you've got a little reserve to operate with. I find there's a very close relationship between how I spend my time, how I spend my money, and this whole thing with stress, the idea of planning with a margin. And so if you know it's going to be a particularly stressful couple of months, a building program or something, and you know it's coming, then we'd be wise to slow down a little bit, not keep going at the same pace. In running, an example would be, if I move along and I know there's a hill coming, I'm not going to go full speed ahead until I hit the hill, because then I've got nothing left. I'm going to slow down, knowing that the hill is coming up, so that I've got some energy left when I hit it, I can get over that thing and down the other side. Okay, another on the list of cures, adopt a biblical attitude toward work and leisure. I'm convinced that many people have an unbiblical attitude toward work and that it consumes everything, or that they don't have a healthy biblical attitude toward leisure. Allow time for recreation, exercise, relaxation. Plan it in your schedule. The fact is, if you wait until you have time to take it, you'll never get it. But there never seems to be any time left over. The work and the demands that will eat up everything. It's not a matter of waiting for the time to be there, but just taking the time, planning it in your schedule to relax, to exercise. Knowing that I'm an A-type personality, I have it in my schedule to run a couple, 2-3 times a week. I play racquetball once a week. I work in such a way at work that I never take anything home with me. So when I get home in the evening, I can spread out in front of the Cosby Show or horse around with the kids because I've not taken anything home yet. Some people, every night, they lug a briefcase thinking they're doing the right thing. Well, if I can just get it done at home, then when I come in next day, it'll be all right. But what happens next day you walk in, there's a brand new pile waiting for you. It seems like you never get to the bottom of it. Now you don't have any evenings left either. It's just like a cancer. It keeps eating up everything. Okay, as much as possible, we've alluded to this a little bit, don't have too many change factors close together. If you realize that there's been a lot of major changes recently, don't add one to it by deciding to move to another house, decide to change another job, decide to change anything radically that has stress incorporated with it. Wait. It's good to talk it over with somebody who knows you well, spouse or otherwise. I'm thinking about doing this, I'm thinking about doing that. Somebody might say, no, don't do it. Wait 3 or 4 months. You've had too many major changes recently. This is going to just probably tip you over the edge. Try to get more control over your life and your decisions as much as lies within you. There's something about having more freedom in my life to make things happen, to say yes or no, to make decisions that alleviates the stress. When I think everything is pre-programmed and everything is planned out and I don't have any say-so, it's very, very high, if not at the top of the list. And I think that's what happens in a lot of jobs where everything is pre-thought out and it's all everything is all laid out for you. It just does something to you. You just feel you're a cog in the machinery and the stress just starts building up. That's fear, and fear in itself is a high stressor. The fear of what might happen, what happens if this, what happens if that. That's what motivates a lot of people to keep going, the fear of something happening if they don't keep achieving and keep producing. Keep your personal relationships in good order. We talked about conflict being, learn to say, I'm sorry. It was my fault. Please forgive me. What did I do to offend you? Is there any way we can make this right? I know in my life, I have experienced a great deal of stress because of unresolved personal conflicts. A fear of going to somebody, feeling they would misunderstand or make even matters worse. Knowing that somebody out there doesn't like me, and yet I have to be around them and work with them. And yet not knowing, should I say something? Should I forget it? Should I just live with it? I can just sense the tightness inside. On pastors, quite often it can be somebody on the elder board or somebody in the church or somebody even on the staff if there's just this conflict and you don't know what to do with it or how to resolve it. So do everything you can to keep the relationships well. As far from your viewpoint, especially watch out for bitterness and anger, resentment, and unforgiving spirit. Another thing that helps in there is to have some good, close, redemptive relationships. Somebody you can really gut it out with and share it. Sometimes it's not your spouse. Especially if you're in the church, it's very difficult, you know, talk about so-and-so jerk of an elder that's given me all kinds of trouble and tell your wife, you know, that poisons your wife, or whatever the case might be. You can be on the elder board and you've got a jerk of a guy on the staff. At least in your viewpoint, he's a jerk. And so you can't share that with other people because you're biasing them and poisoning them. And so who do you share it with? You've got to have some people that you can share it with, that you know it's going to be in confidence. You can get it out of your system. Redemptive relationships that you can bury your soul. I can't speak for the ladies, but it's been my experience in men I've worked with in the 25 years I've been a Christian, that it's when the older we get, the more unusual it is for men, say, in their 40s and 50s, to have really close male relationships with somebody they can really share their hearts with. We have a lot of acquaintances. We say, hi, how are you? And people that respect us, and we have professional peers. But we don't have a lot of close relationships that are redemptive, that really are therapeutic for us in the area of stress and conflicts and things. And we need at least one or two people like that. Okay, adequate amounts of rest and sleep, that's probably pretty obvious. Learn to slow down. We talked about that, pacing yourself. I think we'll stop. There's a couple of more, but I think we've alluded to them already. Let me just close. And what we're going to do is I'll close, and I'm going to have some questions, and I've got some paper here to give you that will help you get an idea of where you're coming from and kind of take your own temperature in this area. But let me close by just making the statement, and I really believe it with all of my heart. It doesn't make too much difference what it is. It's my personal opinion that it's not worth dying for. It's just not worth it. So we've got about 45 minutes left. Let's just take some questions. Feel free to react, interact, disagree, anything that you heard here. You want an amplification on something?
Thinking back what you said about the old men not having a purpose, and that is the one thing my husband has really pushed for in the two churches that we have been pastors. was to type at least one name, and right now he's got three in his chart, that he has accountability with, and vice versa. And he's also doing a discipleship program that he's trying to build into these good guys. And he's doing, like, he started out with 15, and he only got three left. But when the 6 months are over, those three are going to be people that he can have accountability with. But his board members, he was built into them for 4 years, and that can do
good.
And he's got to be able to do that. And, you know, I challenge you as a pastor to do that. Find at least one man. Because, like you say, there's things that he doesn't want to bring to me, put on me, that I can't identify with. And then you can. And if you've got a good elder board or a good man at church that you can work with both ways, I would encourage you, because I see the difference between him and him.
Good. Thank you. Someone else?
What's a good biblical attitude toward leaders? You alluded to that. But I think it's sometimes, I think it's confusing for those of us Christians who work in the secular world to know how to take it biblically, you know, like things that we're taking from basically a humanistic
Yeah, I think there's a... I'm getting tangled up in this thing here. Look, I got a tail. I think there's a difference between entertainment and amusement and recreation and relaxation. Somebody has well made the point, I think it was Dr. Joe Aldridge, that our word amusement comes from two words. The word muse, of course, means to think or to meditate, and when you put awe in front of it, it means not to. So the word amusement means not to think, which is a pretty apt description. A lot of the stuff we get thrown at us is supposed to be amusement or entertainment. But there's a book out that, I've got several books, and I'm going to give you a bibliography in a moment here. But this is one of them. It's just simply entitled, When I Relax, I Feel Guilty. And there are a lot of good things in here about the whole need for recreation and relaxing and getting away in a positive sense. It doesn't need to cost a lot of money. It's going to be a break in the routine. And it can't be something that somebody else tells you is relaxing. What might be relaxing for one person might not be relaxing for the next. So we need to find out what it is that helps us relax. It might be just taking a walk, going down and feeding the ducks. If you're hitting the books all day long, what's relaxing for you might be physical work. If you work physically all day long, relaxing might be cozying up with a book. So it depends on what your usual schedule is.
His last chapter there on the Sabbath, he makes a distinction between rest and how we confuse that with leisure and amusement. I think that's excellent. Ordering your private world.
That's in video also, I understand now.
This coming Sunday night, he starts the doctrine. Order it for the pastor.
I have one verse that's been a favorite of mine for years. I would put this whole thing with rest and relaxation into that verse, and it's Proverbs 14, verse 30. In the Amplified Bible, it says, a calm and undisturbed mind and heart are the life and health of the body. Good verse for a physician. And I need to ask myself, what is it that I can do and put into my schedule that will lead to a calm and undisturbed mind and heart? What is relaxing for me? And there are just so many different types of things. The key is to actually physically put it in your schedule that you block it off. Thursday afternoon or Saturday mornings, I or we are going to do this or that or the other thing. And to identify what it is for you that truly is recreation, recreation. I think of a biblical example, one of them would be, was it Elijah when he went off and sat by himself and God told him to rest and to eat and to sleep. I can't come up with a chapter. So God realized he was very tired and he was depressed and he was wishing he would die and he was the only one left and so on. You recognize the story. And so he went off and he sat down and God basically just told him to rest, to sleep, and furnished him with food. That's what he needed. He was just worn to a frazzle. And they just slipped off by himself.
You're one of the cures here. Try to get more control over your life, more freedom. How do you deal with that in the sense that none of us live in a vacuum. What may give you more freedom may cause more stress in another relationship. I can, for instance, illustrate my own life. Okay, kind of ties into not too many changes. But I own my own home. And with our boys getting almost ready for college, we just have been up against it financially. Well, you know, I've had an awful lot of stress, and yet we had this our home. We moved into a smaller one that we're running currently, simply to try to get a little breathing room financially. But yet that caused other stress factors, but it relieved some other chronic things.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't find canceling out, I find simply paying Peter, you know, Robin Peter, paying Paul.
Well, if the overall stress quotient is dropping, at least you're moving in the right direction. Yeah.
The thing is that if the Lord, you know, I don't feel anything, I could say, well, let's say if he led me into a new line of work. My boy's in high school. It's a terrible time to move.
Yeah, what I meant by control was partly that I have some say-so over what happens to me, rather than everyone else has a say-so and I have no say-so. Somebody put it like this: when you give somebody a task to do, tell them what and tell them why, but don't tell them how. Let them figure out how. That gives you a certain amount of say-so over your job. With the rash of books that's coming out, for instance, with Tom Peters in Search of Excellence, one of the things you find a predominant is Kenneth Blanchard's books on One Minute Manager. I like to read those things. I think they're very biblical, even though the guy that wrote them doesn't understand that they're biblical. But one of the things that predominates in these books is up with people. Give people more freedom to have something to say about what they do and how they do it, and add their own creativity to their jobs rather than having everything pre-programmed, because that just leads to stress and dissatisfaction. So if I have any say-so, and I have two secretaries that work for me here, and I can tell them what I want and let them figure out how to do it and say, you're creative and you can probably do a much better job than I can. You come up with your own ideas. That makes the job more of a challenge and more interesting than if I say 9 o'clock do this and 10 o'clock do this, and then we want this this way and we want that way. Dictated a couple letters yesterday and I said, now you go back over this, see it on your screen, and if you think you can smooth it out or change the paragraphs around or make it nicer, wow, go ahead and do it. You probably have better ideas than I have. I think the more I can do that with them, the more that they feel ownership in what they're doing. And they have some say-so over when they do it and how they do it. And so I'm moving more and more in that direction. So if I can ask somebody else to do that for me, in the church you can ask people to give you more freedom rather than have the board spell out exactly the way they want everything, but trust you a little more and give you more freedom. I think the more freedom people have, the less stress. And what I've read puts that particular item, number one, on the list. Sense of no control over anything. Everything is out of your control. And I still haven't figured out exactly why that's the case, but it seems to be that creates a tremendous amount of stress. Maybe somebody can... have you experienced that? Do you sense that in the job where you have freedom, creativity, you're less stressful than everything is pre-programmed for you?
And yet sometimes it's stressed by getting the board to say you have to do less things by getting them to specify what you don't have to do. Because if it's left completely up, then it's going to come back to the head man, whereas if you say, what bugs me the most is when somebody has something that I'm not involved with at all, but I got to come over and nobody brings the key to open the church. That's ridiculous. Why do I have to go open the church? It's their thing. And so I purposely don't do that. I purposely get there late. And even if they're late, I get there so that, well, did anybody bring a key? So they see that I don't have to open doors. So I think sometimes you have to specify. Yeah. It's good to specify.
That's a good point. And you are creating freedom or margins in your own life so that everything doesn't revolve around you. Very good point. Okay, any other comments, questions?
I was going to say, for me, though, I like to be told that if I don't feel confident enough to make my decision, maybe that's where I'm kind of little in some way. But some of them try to do so, I like them to tell me that too.
How they want it.
It's stressful the other way because maybe they don't like this thing.
Okay, I hear you.
I'm like that. I like to be told what I'm going to do. But I also like to preach. I homeschool my children, and I taught as a teacher for 2 years. So I got the lay of how to do it. So this is great. So then the next 2 years, I've been teaching at home. But I want to
I think there's an underlying reason here that's probably pretty obvious. That is, in some cases, the reason I want somebody to spell out exactly is because I'm afraid of failure. Now, if I knew that the person who was giving me that job wasn't going to get all over my case, if it wasn't done exactly the way they would do it, if they were doing it, I might not want to spell out to the same degree. So I'm trading something off here. I don't want the person all over my case and scold me. I want to be secure and be well liked and so forth, so and therefore I want it all spelled out. But if I was working for a boss who gave me creativity and said, I want you to do it my way. I want you to do it your way so that it challenges you. And as long as it doesn't violate horribly some key principles that we operate, I'll be happy with it. And that could be an interesting situation. You'd have a lot of freedom, and yet you know that nobody was going to get on your case. All the God-given energy and creativity inside of you would start bubbling over. You might find yourself even singing and dancing at work.
Also contributing to that, you mentioned other causes for personality types. I don't know if you're familiar with personality profile, with the four main areas, dominant, etc. And depending on your personality, that makes a world of difference. What would be frustrating to one is bliss to the next. And you just, depends on your personality.
And what is the lifelong experience to discover? Keep rediscovering who you are and how God has wired you up, what motivates you, what depresses you, and so forth and so on. Okay, let me get you started here with something.